Don't talk until it starts. Okay.
So, Reese, you're right in my kitchen now, and we're just going to check this out and see that our levels are good and so on.
Yes, I don't have to yell or do anything.
You're in my kitchen. See that chick there? She's married to this black guy who's a writer. She just cut her hair all off, and now she's learning how to comb it better because she didn't have it together.
The one on the right?
The left, the short blonde. I can just see her. Yeah.
Here we go.
Okay. Well, I have to say, just at the beginning, that it was a good idea that we had these vodkas. Because, you know, it sort of melts the ice, as it were, you know, makes things cozy and stereoize and good to deal with. So we just went for lunch. And, you know, if you take visitors from New York to San Francisco, you have to take them to water. So we went to Mission Rock and we're very full and, you know. And then Reese was talking tremendously engagingly all through lunch. And I was going to... I want to tape it, but he's sort of had this idea. So I'm going to skip around an awful lot, if that's all right with you.
That's fine, Barbara.
Okay. So tell me, first of all, you've been very entertaining about San Francisco and what how beautiful the city is, but there's a big problem. What is that?
Well, I'm a musician and a composer, and I've been working in the field for quite a long time. What you need to have in a city to make things really exciting and to make things work in a contemporary music scene, at least, is three ingredients. The first one is to have really hip composers that have wonderful ideas and write great music. San Francisco certainly has that. You need producers with vision, people who present the work of composers and concert spaces, and San Francisco certainly has that. So what's missing? Well, you also need good critics. You need critics that that love contemporary music and that support it and that understand it. And I'm afraid that, you know, my friend Paul Tresher called me up before I did the concerts at the New Performance Gallery this week and said, Reese, if you're expecting a good review in this town, you can just forget about
good.
It.
Oh, good. I'm happy he prepared you. You know.
And then sure enough, a review came out. I think it was in the Examiner. What does Alan Ulrich write for?
I don't know, because to me they're all interchangeable and they're all dreck.
But I've never received such a review, even in the most backwaters of France or Italy.
Well, you should just take it as... Robert Ashley just takes it as a compliment in this town. I mean, some of his... The reviews that he's gotten here have never, seriously, since the mid-60s, have traditionally, except for Charles Scheer. Charles Scheer is our shining exception.
Right, I heard about him.
And aside from Charles Scheer, there's no one who at all understands anything to do with avant-garde, new music, new art, anything.
It's a shame, and it's very... But they could have international reputations
I know,
if they
write
about
at
the contemporary scene.
Even
this
the
man
newspapers.
Wrote a review, and it was so... He so obviously has no feeling...
Well, they
for
don't understand.
Music. I'm not just saying because he didn't like my music. I could see that he really hates contemporary music.
But I'm
amazingly... So I actually wrote him a letter
that's
and said...
That's what I was going to ask you. Tell us what it said.
I told him that his review is outrageous.
What did
and
you
that,
say? What
and
more?
That,
I like
that, you know, one of the things that's holding back the contemporary music scene in San Francisco is critics like him. Because you can't... You perform the music, but you also need critics to get it out to a wider audience to encourage them to come. And this man isn't really a music critic. He writes about dance. He writes about theater. He writes about a lot of different things. What business does he have coming writing about music that he knows nothing about?
I know.
They should hire someone who really knows about the contemporary field.
I don't know. I think it was Alan.
I told him that. I said, you know, his colleagues in America and Europe don't agree with him. And if they read his review, they think he's a fool.
Well, I think that's the level of the newspapers here. We don't. It's a very sad comment on a town when you don't have a decent newspaper in the city, you know, that you absolutely don't.
Well, as I said before, it's one of the necessary ingredients. What's happening in the new music community is very important, and it's vital for other sorts of music. Many of the ideas that we pioneer get filtered out into popular culture much
later. I know.
And this sort of music is supported in Europe because people are civilized there. But here it seems that people do everything they can to discourage you from composing contemporary music.
Yeah, it is very discouraging, and composers here have to be very
but
intrepid.
There's a saying, you know, when the going gets tough, the tough get going.
Really. It certainly, you know, does make you either
The performances have been very, very nice, and the audiences have been really warm. And I'm making tapes of every night, so I have a wonderful record of
good.
The concert, and the musicians are having a good time. So all in all, I'm very pleased with my stay here.
Well, I like the exuberance with which you come on and with which you perform, and the positiveness. It's really inspiring. And, you know, I've been following you for, I don't know, I guess about the last 6 years.
We've known each other since 1980, I think. Or
since
was 79?
When did you get out to Mills?
That must have been in 79.
That was so intense. That was the time when you were doing solo guitar. And
I worked with the local drummer.
Tall, blonde fellow, you know, this strapping blonde guy slobbering into the mic. Doing this chord, you know, and then I still know, you know, the overtones and harmonics and stuff are going around, zooming around the air. And I noticed that this time, and that made me so happy. All the pulsing and the beating and, you know, when there were all these intervals in the brass.
Well, in the 70s, I was working with the overtone series as a primary musical vocabulary with the work that I was doing with electric guitars. I had an ensemble of guitars. Six guitars that I was working with in New York. And I did that sort of work for the past 6 years.
I thought that was very groundbreaking, wasn't it? You were really about the innovator of that genre, I would say.
I had a guitarist named Glenn Branca in my band who had worked with me and had learned about the overtones for me. I mean, of course, no one has that copyright on the overtones. My teacher was Lamont Young. Done that sort of work, and then there's Harry Parch, and there's
I think it's admirable.
Many, many composers
out
here
that are
working. To be able
to start people on their way.
But I think I exposed a lot of the people in the rock community to being able to work with the overtone series. And Glenn left the band and went on to do, I guess, bigger and better things. And
well, you know, he owes a debt to someone who gave him the idea in the first place, which is wonderful.
But you know, with the new music I'm doing, I was working with guitars for 6 years because I was interested to work with non-notated music of various sorts, and rock music in particular interested me. So I immersed myself in it for a period of 2 years because I didn't want to appropriate another form of music. My background is as an art composer. I just didn't want to just go in and do a piece that was, you know, a composition for rock and roll instruments. That would be missing the point entirely. Actually, I was quite arrogant when I first went into it. I thought, for Christ's sake, I can count to four. It'll be easy for me to play rock. But it did not work out that way. You know, I picked up the electric guitar, and the rhythms all felt foreign to me. So I didn't reject my classical training, but I added on to it because there used to be this question of musical hierarchy in the art music world, with art music on top, jazz somewhere below, and you know, rock wasn't even music in the 50s. But what we discovered in the 60s and 70s is that all of these genres of music are equally valid, but very, very different, with different histories and different evolutions and different bodies of knowledge. So it took me 2 years to even touch the surface of what rock is. But after that period of time, I was able to get into the rhythms, and I was at a rehearsal and I screamed. I said, "I'm actually playing it." I couldn't get over it. I was in a rock and roll band called Arsenal. And
isn't it fun? I know when you
it was a wonderful
breakthrough
experience.
into that idea, and then it seems that you leave it and go back into other things, or you go on, you don't go back. That's what I notice about you,
going
that
on
you
exactly.
keep changing.
Right.
You know, I'm so impressed that you started. When did you start learning trumpet and brass instruments?
To that. But after the rock groups, you know, and working with them for two years. It was only at that point that I felt I could write for the instrumentation. And all the people in the band were coming out of rock backgrounds entirely. And I gave them a sound material to work with, the overtone series. And the way they treated it, I mean, people have been working with the overtones, you know, for all of a century.
Sure.
You know, and the Indian music, of course, their whole system is based on that. But I thought it was really interesting to see what would happen if rock musicians worked with this vocabulary. And what happened was that we created a new music. You know, a music that came out of the classical avant-garde in the formal aspects, but with a definite rock feel, you know, that only rock musicians, classical musicians never could have played the music in that way.
How did the dancers, like I know Carol Armitage and I don't know who else, just adapted, you know, they used your music for ballet, you know, for their dances. How did that work out?
I wanted to be a dancer when I was younger.
No, I didn't.
But I wanted to be either a mathematician or a musician or a dancer.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't start dance until very late. I was 19.
What kind of dance?
I studied Hawkins technique, modern dance. And I had been doing music since I was 8. And when I took the modern dance classes, it was so difficult. I thought I better stick to something where I can make a real contribution.
I'm doing
so
ballet
I'm living
now.
Vicariously through these dancers that I've been working with. I've been working with dancers since 1968.
Who have you worked with?
Daniel Nagrin, Meredith Monk, Ted Rotante, Kenneth King, Lisa Fox, and currently I'm working with a dancer named Eve Muzard, who's coming to a new performance gallery later on. Carol, though, you spoke of Carol Armitage, was very, very brave because...
She's the
New
one
York,
that I read about in Vogue, you and she.
In New York between 75 and 80, there weren't many interesting collaborations between choreographers and musicians. We'd had the thing with Cage and Cunningham, but it was sort of dead. And dancers tend to use pretty music. Music that would, you know, obviously complement their dancing and act as wallpaper. But Carol wanted something really violent. And she was very, very brave to use the music. We did a piece called Drastic Classicism, which was extremely aggressive and loud, dealing with the overtone series, but also encompassing the punk gesture, you know, of violence.
Yeah.
And Carol and I's background was very similar in that she comes out of a classical background, ballet, and so do I, but we're both seeking to undermine that whole training and coming up with something
different.
What
was the scoring? Was it live?
It was scored for 4 electric guitars and drums through 3,000 watts of amplification and 5 dancers. And I'll tell you, it's very easy to overpower dancers, but she had such a good company consisting of Chris Komar, Joseph Lennon, Debbie Riley, such fine dancers that they were able to equal the music. And sometimes even surpass it. It was incredibly intense.
Yeah, I remember when you won, when Reese wants Wattage. I mean, we went all over town. Melody Sumner and I did the music festival. Reese and lots of other people came from New York to do it. And Reese wanted a Marshall amp. And you were the only one that wanted a Marshall amp. And we borrowed digital delays. We borrowed Eventide harmonizers. We borrowed everything. We couldn't borrow a fucking Marshall amp. It's the only piece of equipment we
rented.
I
wasn't using the harmonizer, by the way.
What?
I wasn't using the harmonizer.
No, John Giorno was. Right. But we had to actually rent a Marshall amp.
Oh, I'm sorry, Barbara.
Arto
Lindsay liked it, too.
Arto Lindsay liked it, and he used it, too. What would you like?
I'm just going to get another vodka.
Oh, I see. So I'm going to move along now. I want to skip from music for a while. So I was just saying that we were going, you know, Reese went and to freshen our vodkas. And even though I don't need any, I mean, it's not a question of what you need. It's really a question of what you want. So I did want a bit of a topper, shall we say. So I got it. But Reese wants to talk about the trumpet, and I want to talk about his two wives.
Well, let's talk about the two wives. Then.
So we'll quickly discuss the two wives, and then we'll move into trumpet, because it seems to me that the two go hand in glove. As I see it, it's all one big continuum, and Reese is just looking extraordinarily skeptical about that. But you mentioned that your two wives were sort of very vaguely Virgo and vaguely African, and you said what Isabel said, if she ever sees you, she's not really very possessive, she's not very jealous, but if she ever sees you looking at what, she will kill. She'll go for blood. What was that?
She has a Latin temperament. And when I'm on tour, she knows that I don't mess around, because if I do, she can see right through me. I might get a stiletto in this.
He said he's not afraid of her on a daily level. It's not a day-to-day level, but he said he's definitely afraid that if he fools around.
We're both touring people, so it's very nice. You know, I've been with other artists as lovers, and it's a very uncomfortable feeling when your lover's on tour to think that they're
a friend of mine went through that this summer.
And maybe they won't come back. It's nice to know.
Well, what's good is to have a balance that, you know, you both go on tour, so there's not one stay at home, as it were.
So here I am in San Francisco, and she's an ange. She's a dancer.
That's right.
She's working with Yves Mouzard, a choreographer, and they're working on a piece in France, and then I'm touring, and we have someone staying at home minding the cats, which is very nice.
Oh, how many cats?
Two cats.
I love
Siamese.
Two cats are great.
Moosh and Sheepy.
You know what I think is great that you've, for years, I don't know when you first started, was it soon after I first met you, that you've been going to Europe regularly to perform, and that is so gratifying, I think, because I was just there for a month, and I wasn't even performing, just checking the scene out, and I was just treated like a composer and like a personality, and I loved it.
Europe has a tradition of supporting the arts and thinking that art is important, unlike America. The arts are beginning to be supported here, but people don't think art is important. People think that movies are important, or of course, commercial movies are art. But what we're doing is important also, even though it's not as commercially successful. And Europeans understand this, which is why I like going there so much.
So what's your
plan? The thing about that is that this is interesting. Americans go over to Europe all the time, and someone like Laurie Anderson, before she became so popular, for 10 years was going to Europe as a performance artist. And American artists had nothing much to do with European culture. Our culture is very different, but Europeans are so interested in art.
I know.
And they're so interested in art culture, aren't they? And then they come over here. This wonderful choreographer, Jean-Claude Galota, came over to City Center in New York. And the New Yorkers there were so territorial, I couldn't get over
really?
It. They didn't like it.
But
the reasons that they didn't like it sounded mighty suspicious to me. It seemed what Jean-Claude Colotta was doing was building on Cunningham's work and using that as a vocabulary, but taking it a step further in a kind of postmodernist sort of way. By bringing sex directly into his choreography.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How so?
Yeah. Oh, just like obvious sexual relationships happening between the dancers and dealing with it directly in a way that a modernist choreographer who deals with pure movement wouldn't do. But still, he dealt with movement and addressed issues that had to do with movement, which I think he's a wonderful choreographer. He's from Grenoble in France.
What's your plans? You said that you want to live in Paris. You and Isabella are going to live in Paris part of the time.
Yeah. And I'm going to split my time between Isabelle. My wife Isabelle Marteau is French, and I think that we'll live in Paris half of the time and New York the other half of the time.
That sounds ideal.
Split my time out, because I would never want to leave America because I'm from here, and this
is my
home.
It's just got wonderful. It's still a great place in its own way.
I'm looking forward to perfecting my French. And, you know, there's a wonderful scene happening in Paris right now. Not so much in music. I don't like what's happening in music
there. What were you saying about the philosophy scene?
About the semiologists.
What's going on?
Oh, there's all this incredible stuff happening. You know, in the 50s, Jean-Paul Sartre was the rage with existentialism. Uh-huh. Now there's a man named Lyotard and L'Étranger and... of course, there was Roland Barthes before he died. Really wonderful school of philosophy.
So are you reading their things?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's great.
It's a post-Marxian sort of view, you know, dealing with what it... Well, there's this one French philosopher named Paul Virilio who wrote a book in the Semiotext series, which is published by Columbia University, that talks about how there's been an amazing amount of research done into the economy by philosophers like Engels and Adams and Marx. But now what we need in the 80s is more research into the economy of speed. I mean, for example, let's think about speed for a minute. In the time of Khrushchev and Kennedy, if someone accidentally pressed that fatal button, you had a half an hour to react.
Yeah, what do you have now? Milliseconds,
between
I'm
Regan
sure.
And the new one. How do you pronounce his name? Gorbachev?
Gorbachev.
It's down to between 3 and 5 minutes now.
Oh, we even have that much?
Yeah. And within
because
the next 20 years, with technology going the way it's going, the fate of mankind will be in the hands of an answering machine. So what we need to do is figure out a post-Marxian, you know, philosophy, because like Marxism, you know, obviously isn't working. What we have in Russia is a deformed worker state, and capitalism has its problems too, Lord knows. You know, we need something new. You know, it's time for you know, a new Adams or a new Marx. And so I'm hoping it's going to be one of these guys. And in talking
maybe
to them,
well
they're all like around my age, and they're nuts.
Great.
They're out of their mind.
Great.
They're just like you and me.
Well, I hope that when I'm there, you know, that I can get to meet them. So you were saying that it was great. How rents in New York have determined what the state of the art is going to
well,
be.
I'm
and that it's made
yeah.
from mediocrity in the arts lately. And this is a very interesting concept that I haven't heard before. Still, we're still on economics, of
well,
course.
I'm a staunch New Yorker, and I grew up there, and born and raised. And I love New York. I love the city. I love San Francisco, too. I like a lot of different places, but I'm from New York, and so
yeah,
I'm proud
I'm
of my city.
Yeah, I'm not tremendously partisan. I'm from Montreal.
But anyway, be that what it may, you know, we had a wonderful music and dance scene in the 60s and 70s because if Yvonne Rainer, for example, who's a wonderful choreographer, was doing Trio A, you know, she could afford to spend a year on the piece in the 60s because, like, we were paying for 2,000 square feet. I was paying $200
oh, God.
A month. You know, now choreographers
makes
have to
Ill.
Pay $8 or $10 an hour
makes
for
me
a studio.
Ill.
I mean, it,
yeah,
it means
course.
Out of necessity you're going to have to get the pieces out faster and there's going to be less thought. And it's hurting the art scene. Now, if you're a young person just out of art school or out of music school coming to New York City, for a hole in the wall, 40 square feet, you're paying $800 in the East Village right now.
Oh, that hurts.
This is up $200 from last year.
It's not very different in San Francisco, by the way.
No, I know. I know. And so, no, but it's a shame. Like, we were all in Greenwich Village in the 50s, and then it moved to Soho, you know, community of artists or an artist ghetto, however you want to look at it. Then it went to Tribeca, then to Chelsea, and now everyone's in the East Village. People I knew 12 years ago are hanging out in the East Village now.
And that's even shrinking up fast.
And now the rents are going up so high there.
So you're saying that they can't
spend. No one knows where to move now.
Then they can't spend the year on the piece. So now it's becoming what? It's called. It's under the umbrella of performance art, and you were saying that it's really not the same scope.
You know, there's a revitalization in dance in New York with people like Melissa Fenley, Armitage, Bill T. Jones, Charles Moulton, Jim Self, Joanna Boyce. But then after that, the focus went away from concern with movement, which is a modernist concern, mm-hmm. but and focused more on performance and talking, which is nice, but I love movement, and I want to see dance, and I'm all for you know, people who give little speeches while they do their dancers. I mean, I like that kind of work, but I do want it to be about movement. And my suspicion is that a lot of this work is coming out of a necessity of having to pay $8 an hour rent.
Yeah,
you know, doing something that's
amazing.
Cute, that's something that's entertaining, but unfortunately not very deep.
Well, that's, you know, that's the case in all the arts, because any serious movie critic is saying, you know, the movies that we all love to go to, like, and I love them too. I've seen them all twice, like, let's say Ghostbusters and Hollywood Cops and Back to the Future and this and that. They're cute and they've got terrific special effects, but they're totally mediocre. So it's well known that this, the last decade and probably the future, is that we're very content. Rent or no rent, we're just totally content with some kind of mediocrity.
Well,
it's
I'll
kind
tell
of
you, Barbara,
worrisome.
In my, this word postmodernism is something that's been thrown around
so
quite a lot
of
late.
Of
but
it.
I'll tell you this much. In my view, there are two types of postmodernism. There's the good kind and there's the bad kind. Okay? So here's the bad kind. Let's talk about the bad kind of postmodernism. The bad kind of postmodernism is that sort of postmodernism which seeks to totally reject our modernist heritage and go back to nostalgia and tradition, Reaganomics mm-hmm. in short, neoconservatism in short is an example of the bad type of postmodernism. The good type of postmodernism, in my view, is those people who take the modernist period, you know, at the beginning of this century, mm-hmm. you know, and its passion for expanding vocabulary in different ways and trying out new ideas, and seeking to demystify it and decode it and to build upon it, That's what I think that the job of artists is right now, and that's the sort of work that I tend to like, and I'm trying to do
is
myself.
Is that what you're doing?
Yeah.
What have you got? What are you working on right now?
Well, for the past 2 years, the reason I got in the guitar stuff in the first place is that I wanted to do something in keeping with these principles I just outlined.
Mm-hmm. That, which I think you that, succeeded in.
That not only that was accessible to a larger group of people than I had been dealing with before, but would also work on a formal level, you know, a formal mm-hmm. level in art music, and also work on a personal level. That friends of Reese Chatham, who know me very well, says this is a music that Reese should be doing. This is true for him. I mean, that's actually the first thing that we mm-hmm. all have to do. And I wanted the music to work on all three of those levels, and to use as a vocabulary something that's truthful for me, which is why I deal with a modernist vocabulary, but try to put it in a way that's more accessible to people.
What
I'm working on right now, you just asked that.
The opera is what I want to hear about. Is that what you were going to say?
You know, you're always a step ahead of me. I was going to talk about the brass work.
Okay, talk about the brass work
first. Talk about the guitar stuff.
Because I did want to talk about the brass work, because suddenly I heard Reese playing a trumpet. And I thought he was going to stroll out with the guitar. But I did know he came with brass ensemble and a drummer. So... And he was very good.
Well, you know,
So this is 2 years that you've been playing? I can't believe it.
I've been playing trumpet for 2 years.
Yeah, and George Lewis is proud of you, too, isn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, George Lewis, when I started playing
good
trumpet,
man.
And he saw I was really
Reese
playing
is my
it,
man.
Serious, he said, well, Reese, welcome to the school of sore lips. For any trumpet players out there, I know you'll know what I'm talking
yeah,
about.
We were
it's
having
a devilishly
lunch.
Difficult instrument to play.
Reese was sorry that he doesn't have, you know, nice big lips like George does. Is it easier to play that
Although
way?
Although people with thin lips can also play brass instruments.
So no, I was telling you about
it just hurts
Toyoshi
a little
Tomita.
Bit more, but you can.
Well, sometimes
it's still
pain
possible.
Has its own end, you know.
But I think the point is that I don't like writing for instruments that I don't play.
Uh-huh.
You know, I did a record on the MERS music label for brass, which yeah, I'm trained as a composer, so I know my orchestration. I wrote well within the ranges of the instruments. But if I didn't have, George Lewis was the one that contracted these people. They're absolutely top-notch people. In addition
he
to being classical players.
These people that we met?
No, on the MERS music
oh,
record.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
In addition to playing classical music and studying at Juilliard stuff, they all play in Broadway shows
yes.
like Cats. And they're used to playing extremely high notes, you know, have great endurance. And so I wrote a piece. It was a good piece. But now that I'm playing the instrument, I really know how to write for brass instruments, mm-hmm. you know, and get the phrasing better and take into account their lips. And so that with I came with a group to New Performance Gallery. We were just doing a series of performances. And it's very difficult for brass players to do a whole program by themselves. It's the most intense thing they can do. And because I'm playing the instrument myself, I know how to write so that they can... you know, successfully do this whole program of very, very intense music.
Yeah, I found it very satisfying.
You know, the reason I got into brass instruments, Barbara, I'm sorry about letting you talk very much.
No, well,
I'm
the interviewer shouldn't talk much. She
no?
should just drink and
oh, but you can talk.
Ask pointed questions. Yes, but I mean, it's not, you know, I'm just facilitating this. Do you like this music in the background? Because
oh,
we
yeah.
can change it. If
No, I like it.
I think
Can
it's their. I think it's their music, actually, and they're sort of happy that it's going to be on this tape.
In any case, I wanted to get into notated music somehow. You know, I've been working with non-notated music for 6 or 7 years, and I thought, what kind of music can I do that's notated and still has the kind of angular, tough rhythms that I know in rock and roll? And I didn't want to do something that didn't sound wimpy, and so I thought of using military music as a model. Is a musical model.
I know, that was, we all laughed. Did you hear us laughing?
No,
because
I didn't.
It starts up, they start off, they're totally note for note, you know. Almost
it's like classical
like,
music concert.
That's not one of them, but I mean, they're very, very traditional bugle, isn't it?
Oh,
bugle
that's right.
calls
yeah.
and all sorts of things, and then they
German
suddenly skew off, you know.
Totally
it's
undermine
great,
it.
It's wonderful. They just skew off into these wonderful harmonies. And wonderful seconds, you know, and things like that. And it was great. And then all the pulsing and beating starts. And it was very exciting. I liked
Some
it.
Some people get upset by the idea of military music. Because, you know, I mean, who wants to think
please.
About destruction and military and stuff like that?
Oh, please. But I mean, we're so far. I mean, you know, they're doing the missile centers and the computer thing. They're not playing military things. We're talking, you know, 200-300 years ago or something. We're talking ancient times or even early 20th century.
That, Barbara?
What did you mean?
How do you mean?
Well, people to be upset. You're saying people were upset by military music?
Oh, but people do get upset.
I mean, they identify.
My audience is an art music audience.
Oh,
and when they
please.
Come and hear this and hear these military rhythms, they think I'm a fascist.
And I do very raunchy songs, and certain people just go like, why do you hate men and this and that, and this isn't music? You know, and people, there's always going to be some people upset. And you know what I realized? They love to be upset. They love to make
is
a brouhaha.
I knew it was something.
They love it. They love it. They don't come enough, so they like to do that and get upset. That's my theory of it all. And I want to get off art for
Barbara,
a minute
I
and
think,
into
wait,
the
I just want to talk a little bit more about it. I think there is a tendency when you bring music into your home and play on the record player, you want to listen to something that'll relax you.
Well, I've always liked marching
nice
bands.
I do too. I love hearing marching bands, and that's one of the reasons I wrote about it. But there's also political implications, for God's sakes.
Well, of course there are, and I'm sure that you mean to have them in a certain way. I mean, are you making
you can
a
read
statement?
Your own story. I mean, this could be
that's the point.
Some of these songs could be military bands could be playing them as the troops march off to Grenada.
Well, the thing is, but then your versions get skewed and changed. So it's the
art.
They are
a little perverse.
They are the art version. So maybe they're saying, you know, don't march off now. March backwards or march into the next bar or don't kill or, you know, something like that.
I think that we should be thinking about the nuclear buildup right now. I don't have any answers, but I think it's something that should.
I agree.
Maybe someone out
there
will
come
up with the answer.
So is that what you're subliminally getting at?
And it's something I read about in the news all the time, and so I'm writing about it.
This music is getting louder and louder, and it's sort of getting in my way.
I could
it's
turn the
very
tape off,
loud, yeah. Actually. Okay, well, Reese really likes it, so. Reese is the boss.
What is it? What is the music again that we're hearing in the background?
Beach Ogres.
Oh. Yeah.
Have you heard his older music, his other stuff? He did, like, when I first met him, he was performing at Mills College. I was just saying, like, as I was slobbering into the microphone, he's like this, you know, 6-foot-tall blonde, and he all dressed in black. And he just, like, got up there, and he played one chord for maybe. Ellen, this is Reese.
Hi, how you doing?
He played one chord for how long?
Oh, it was about, I think, a 30-minute set.
It was amazing.
When we did this stuff initially in Max's Kansas City and CBGB's, people said, Jesus, most punk bands play two chords. This guy can only play one. Those are the people that were missing the point.
Yeah. It was great. It was absolutely great.
I think I saw you once at the kitchen party. Yeah. The Bond.
Oh, theater. Bond. Yeah. That was very late.
Yeah,
that was
fantastic.
That was a good set.
Yeah. The whole thing was great.
You're Bob, aren't you?
No, he's Mark.
Oh, Mark? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're on the air.
She realizes Kenny's here or something. I think she was going to Kenny's house recently.
Uh-oh. Well, when did you first lose your virginity?
Oh, Barbara, there's some things that have to remain private. My goodness.
You're so cool. Usually I throw this at people and they're just like talking about their musical theories and they go, oh yeah, when I was 18 and they just...
Oh, you're a dear friend.
Think
I know
I'm
you.
Asking, you know, some kind of music question. Well, it deals with your art life because I'm sure, you know, didn't your art flower after that or...
When? After sex?
After you lost it. You know, after you lost your cherry.
Oh, it was so early on.
Was it? How old? Were you really young? Under 15?
No, I wasn't that young. No, no.
Between 15 and 20?
Oh, he's getting nervous. He's getting nervous.
Was it between the age of 15 and 20?
I met my first wife in the rock group that I... The first rock group that I was playing called the Gynecologists. Which was organized by Robert Appleton. And my wife's name is Nina Cannell.
I was
wife.
Always grateful to Nina because when
Do you
I
know
stayed
Nina?
No, but when I stayed at
you had
56
that beautiful
McDougal,
coat.
I didn't have a warm coat to wear because I was determined not
she
to bring heavy coats
for a living.
And so all her stuff was hanging. In the, remember the long hall on McDougal?
Yeah, with all her
and
junk
it was
in
all
it.
Nina's junk in the. So Reese just said
she
he was
no
very magnanimous. He just
point.
Said, you know, just borrow anything you want. So I was wearing this leopard
coat. Beautiful leopard skin coat.
I loved
Isabel's
it.
Isabel's wearing that now too.
You like mean Kurt, you mean the stuff is still there? You still
well,
have.
Well, Nina came back.
You are so patient.
Well, Nina came back.
We're talking 10 years.
Isabel, remember, she's a French wife, right?
Yeah.
And she saw all of Nina's stuff in there. And because, well, what happened was I moved into Isabel's place when I got married to her.
Was that on 2nd or something?
On First Avenue.
Yeah, right.
And St. Mark's. And I also
right.
moved all of Nina's stuff. And
oh my
I think
God.
It's only
He's
because
so
she's
reliable.
A Virgo that, you
They're
know, and a very
Virgo,
stable
eh?
person. That,
They're both
that,
Virgo?
Yes. That, that she stood up for it as long as she did because, you know, French women, you know, former
hey.
Girlfriend stuff, they don't want to hear about it. But then Nina came into town.
And they got along well.
They got along really
yeah,
well.
That
and
always and happens.
And, you know, Nina's like my sister now. I mean, I don't have any sisters.
But you always
so
have to beware when you're both your women get along.
Because
they're always talking about you.
Oh, I'm not afraid. And I don't...
You're not afraid.
You know...
you have no fear.
Nina is
That's
also
great.
A Virgo. And I think they have better things to talk about than me.
But you didn't lose your virginity with your first wife.
No.
Okay.
In fact, I was a member of the Jehovah's Witnesses sect. It was a minister for them for a period of time. And I got thrown out of Jehovah's Witnesses for... singing songs to Shiva because I study with Pandit Pranath,
who is
a wonderful Indian singer that sometimes teaches at Mills College.
I took a few classes.
And for gross sexual immorality.
And what?
For gross sexual immorality.
Oh.
Simply because I was living with a woman in a loft in Soho and
Big
there weren't
deal.
Any walls. And it wasn't true. No, I wasn't sleeping
oh.
with her. I was sleeping with the girl upstairs. But so you're getting it all out of me.
What
Barbara,
were your parents well. Like?
Well, they're wonderful people. My father's a Marxist-Leninist. He's a founding member of Spartacist League, which is a group that many other Trotskyite organizations hate. But
well,
it's
they
a very
all
pure,
hate each other.
They all hate each
yeah.
other. Yeah. Yeah. But it's a pure Trotskyite organization and. My mother is a Jehovah's Witness, and they both get along famously because neither of them like the present government. My
yeah.
mother believes in a theology, and my father believes in the revolution.
And you grew up right on McDougal
and so
Street.
And so I had to make a choice. I had to make a choice. Was I going to be into Marx or into God?
Really?
And I liked my mother better as I was growing up, so I chose God. And... but then as I got older, I really got into what my father was such a schmuck. I mean, he's really into philosophy.
What
into
is he,
Marxist,
Welsh?
Welsh back.
Yeah.
But he wasn't a good teacher. I mean, we didn't relate well until I became an adult. And now, because I'm an ex-Jehovah's Witness, you know, my mother is not allowed to talk to me. You know, so I'm completely estranged from my mother.
Really?
I always keep my door open.
Yeah.
You know, whenever if she wants to, you know, talk to me, it's fine.
It's terrible.
But the thing is, because I was thrown out, excommunicated, disfellowshipped, for a decision that I made when I was 11 years old.
Incredible.
That we can't have a social intercourse.
I made up my mind when I was
it's
12.
Sick. I think it's
that
sick.
There
religions
was no
like
God,
this are sick.
You know?
Because although I have nothing bad to say about the teachings of Jehovah's Witnesses, I think it's
a little dogmatic, a little heavy.
You know, well, for a person, both my mother and myself, to be penalized for a decision I made when I was 11
that's
years
terrible.
Old is not right.
That's terrible.
I think that, but that's not very godly. It's not very Christian.
So they're writers?
And they're both writers, yeah. Let's see, my mother was a playwright in the 50s, but it was very difficult for women to get their plays on. There was no off-Broadway.
Tell me about it. It's still difficult
then.
For women
and
to do anything.
And she was very discouraged, and I think that's the reason she got into Jehovah's Witnesses.
Uh-huh.
And my father is a novelist, and then they both had writer's blocks for a period of time. And now they're both working together
on an historical novel.
On a historical novel, and they're calling the name of the author Gina Price. Which is my father's first name and my mother's first name.
So when is it due? Is it going to be published?
It should be out soon. They're almost done with it. They've been spending the last 5 years on it. More power to them.
So what's the very first music you recall hearing as a very tiny, tiny
Stravinsky,
boy?
The History of a Soldier.
Oh, my God. You see, most people just are so... See, these prosaic things.
Oh,
I knew you
just
wouldn't.
Amazed. It's the first piece of music I'm hearing. You know... Every time I hear it, it brings tears to my eyes.
Yes, everyone
bum,
says
bum,
that.
Bum, 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 bum. Da, 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 da.
So did you love it?
Well, it's just the first piece of music I remember hearing, and I was amazed.
Where did you hear it? In your home?
My parents' home on McDougal Street when I was 3 or 4.
What was your address on McDougal?
56.
What?
It's the same building that
Oh my God, I'm really going to burst out crying now, because when I first met Reese, and it was almost my first trip or my second trip to New York, but it was the first real beginning of my, you know, really going regularly to New York. I really stayed with Reese and Michael Byron at 56 McDougal. I can't believe it was 56.
And we lived in the apartment right below where I lived.
It was pure happenstance that
I happened to move into that apartment. And I'll tell you, when I first moved
I saw
the same colors on the walls in the same place. It really brought back memories, let me tell you.
So what was it like when you were, like, as a kid, village must have been
$16 per month.
$16
per month.
Oh, my God.
It was a cold water flat. You know, my parents were both beatniks.
Wow.
You know, in the 50s.
God. What I would have given for parents like that. Anything.
But I didn't start playing an instrument until I was 8. And I took up the clarinet in public school. And my parents encouraged me. I also played harpsichord because my father was a musician.
Uh-huh. So what? Were you an only child?
Yeah. I have a half-brother. My mother was married before.
And
he's a carillonier at the University of Chicago.
A what?
One who rings church bells.
Ah. So what schools did you go to in New York?
I went to, I went to public school, PS 40 and 104 initially.
God.
And then I just was so sensitive that I couldn't stand the public school system. This was in the 60s, and since my parents were both educated, they took me out of school, and I was educated privately.
So,
and then I went to NYU later and studied with Morton Subotnick, who's before he went out to CalArts.
I like him and his wife Joan a lot.
He is a wonderful, wonderful teacher.
I always pull his beard and play with it.
Do you? I
do.
I don't do that.
I do.
I'm too still.
Well, there was a time when I was very friendly with one of his friends, which I won't name now, because if I name this person or even give his initials, he'll phone me up on the phone.
Yeah. Who? Who?
So if I mention this friend of Mort's anytime, even initials, I get a phone call late at night.
From who?
This person that I just mentioned to you. And it's ridiculous. But anyway, get back to Mort Subotnick. I love his music, and he's a lovely man. And
well,
so is his wife, Joan.
Yeah, something else I wanted to say was that that I have a profound understanding of the Buchla synthesizer, you know, because through my work with Mort, I must have spent hundreds and hundreds of hours working on the Buchla 100 series.
You mean the very first?
Yeah, the very first.
Yeah.
And,
well, certainly a groundbreaker.
Because I was playing flute at that point. That was my instrument of virtuosity. And, you know, and Mort turned me on to the Buchla synthesizer, and it changed my life. You know, and I played it and, you know, and really got into it. And just recently, I started work on the Buchla 400, which is digitally controlled instrument. And the teacher who was teaching me how to use it was amazed because I picked it up faster than anyone he knew.
So it's because you had the initial.
I understand the way the man's mind works, because I understood the logic, because it's just become second nature to me.
What did Phil Glass say to you about sex?
Oh, I'll talk about it later.
Come on, Reese.
Oh, well,
strike
you know, we were both sitting
hot
in a bar, and looking out at the street, and Phil said to me, Reese, you know, you get older, and it doesn't get less. I thought it would get less, but it doesn't. And we both laughed.
So do you need any more to drink? Because you can talk.
No, I'm fine.
Okay. Tell me now about the stipulation your mother-in-law made. His mother-in-law lives in Paris, and they also have a house in the south of France. And she said you can go windsurfing on a holiday
if Isabel's mother is a southern mother, because they're all from really Algeria before the revolution. And Isabel was born in Algeria.
Oh, I see.
And her father's in oil. And then after the revolution, they moved to Paris. But a Mediterranean mother is very similar to a Jewish mother. And that she's the real power in the family. And I love her so much because she's a Pisces and I'm a Virgo. And there's that natural sort of attraction. And I stayed with her for 3 weeks. And you must realize Isabel's parents are very bourgeois in the sense of they look at me and they look at another of their son-in-laws. And one is making $50,000 a year without even trying. And they think Isabel's supporting me because I'm a musician and we don't make much money. Isabel isn't supporting me. Our marriage is a Dutch treat.
Dutch treat.
Yeah. And... but nonetheless, she realized that Isabel would be in America with me. And so she made friends with me. She was very smart. And I love her. And she said to me, Reese, well, they have a house in the south of France. And I went, I learned how to windsurf.
Where? Do you know? Where?
What outside of Toulon. In a small town called Saint-Raphael.
On the Mediterranean?
And yes. And let me tell you, you know, there's always talk about the south of France and the beaches there, but it's just like a French version of the Coney Island as far as I'm concerned. I mean, everyone can take their bras off and stuff like that. But, I mean, frankly, I prefer that they keep them on. I don't know.
That happened to me on this Italian island. Everyone had their bras off, you know, their little bikinis. Thank God I had this really tiny Italian bikini, but which I'd gotten in the Dolomites. Do you remember Kenneth Atchley?
Vaguely.
He and I went up to the... He's this Tennessee guy. He did all the tech and music. But anyway, I just didn't feel... I'm not shy at all. I'm kind of brazen. But don't agree. But I just
agree
didn't...
With you.
You weren't supposed to. But I didn't want to take my top off because I...
And why should you have
now
to?
Now listen to why I didn't want to. I was the biggest one there. This was before
biggest
the tourists.
Biggest in what sense?
Biggest breasted woman.
I see.
And I... Everyone had these tiny things. You know, they were all pretty flat. And if I would have taken my top off, you'd see mega. You know, it was a mega tit.
Yeah.
And I wasn't into it. I didn't want to make show.
Well, I enjoy the sense of mystery. And,
that's what I thought.
And for me, that's too much of a demystification.
Once in a blue moon.
But
no,
I mean, I think anyone
Reese.
Should look.
Listen,
I think
Reese, you want to get, if you're a woman, let me just... So we're talking about what women do on a nude beach. You really do, even though you want to keep up the sense of mystery and elusiveness and so on, the reason that women will take their tops off is because you really want kind of an even tan. What you might not want to do is take your bottom off, because women are just right there and they're just open and you just don't want to lie there with your legs spread, you know, especially if you're on the rag with your little string
that.
Hanging
and
out. So you'll leave your bottom on, but you know, you want to take your top off.
I think everyone should do whatever they want.
Yeah, I do too, basically.
No, I was only kidding before.
But you know, it does take away the sense of mystery when, you know,
true.
I think men's bodies are really funny looking too.
I think they
just like these things like flopping around.
But anyway,
I don't want to see another new one for a year. I'm telling you.
When I was in the south of France, I had the opportunity to windsurf.
Uh-huh.
It takes 3 days, and there's a lot of cursing that goes on when you can't get the sail up and when you have no idea what the wind's doing. But then you get up, and it's really a wonderful sport. And Isabel's mother said to me that because she's a very wise woman, that if I want to come back to France and stay in their house on the southern shore, that I have to learn to speak French first.
Well, I heard your accent, and really, when you try, it's really quite beautiful.
Un bière, s'il vous plaît.
No, that's his bad accent. He told me that's his bad accent when people are being really snotty.
Oh,
so please tell me about the opera.
Oh, yes.
That you're writing.
Well, my goodness. It
seems
sorry
to bring you back.
That you run into these days is doing an opera.
I know.
You know? And we
and
wonder what's
and they call everything
the
that has voice
right
in
now.
It is called an opera, too.
Yeah.
It's a very wide range of what is called opera.
Yeah, everyone's jumping into it, so I'm the latest edition.
I think it's wonderful, and you've got a couple of grants and so on.
Well, you know, at the NEA, the music program is extremely conservative. The people that sit on the panel, not all of them, but most of them, tend to come out of a modernist tradition and tend to give grants to people who write like them. And it's very sad because in the dance program at the NEA, in the inter-arts program and the other programs, it's very enlightened. The peer panels give grants to young people who really deserve them, and from all different parts of the field. But in music, it's just not the case. However, in opera musical theater, there's some wonderful, wonderful people, very enlightened, who are sitting from throughout the country,
wonderful,
that are sitting on the panel. And
wonderful,
I think this is the
news,
reason why there's so many people starting to write operas now. See, because if you're a composer, and I make my living through my work, and this is unheard of. I mean, when John Cage and Merce Cunningham were washing walls at the YWCA when they were both in their 30s, late 30s.
John said that only in his 60s.
He didn't get his first grant until he was 40.
Something like that.
You know, and because people probably a lot because of the baby boom, and a lot of people can apprehend this music that we're doing. We're getting better support now. We're not making what we should, but things are better.
So when will we hear this opera?
We got a grant from the NEA.
And when is it?
Create the opera. And it's with a wonderful visual artist that I've been working with for the past 2 years.
Who's that?
Named Joseph Nekvatal.
I want to meet him.
He's a lovely, lovely man and a wonderful visual artist. And also another wonderful person named Richard Flood, who is a writer for Art Forum, and he's helping us with the lyrics, and he's going to direct the opera. And then we got a grant from the Massachusetts Council on the Arts.
How did you get that?
We just applied.
Great.
Well, I should tell you about it. I mean, the people that sit on those panels are just wonderful. They really want to bring art into Massachusetts, and they're bringing people from all over the country to do beautiful, beautiful pieces in Boston and other areas.
I've heard great things about Boston lately, by the way.
Yeah.
When are we all going to hear this? When's the premiere?
Oh my goodness. In April or May.
Next year? 86?
Through the auspices of the Brattle Theater in Boston. Oh, in Cambridge, actually. We'll be presenting the opera in this old decrepit opera house. The title of the opera is Excess.
Just X. It's an X and an S, by the way.
Which has to do with the whole idea of overload, the overload of the 80s. Involving a number of performers and sopranos and male singers and brass bands and guitar bands. It'll be a real extravaganza. So as soon as I leave San Francisco, I'm going back to finish up the writing.
Great.
You know, I have a lot of work to do before April.
I think I'd like to go come out and hear it.
Oh, great.
So how are we doing on time? Do you have anything more that you want to say?
Sure.
I think I still have a couple of things I want to ask you.
We have plenty of time, Barbara.
Good. Tell me about Brian Eno. You had a story about Brian Eno. Do you remember what it was?
No.
You were being so entertaining at lunch. Now, let's see what it was. Well, I don't care because I have another question, and we'll get back to Brian Eno. I know it was something.
Oh, I remember what...
Someone asked him to contribute something or something.
I remember,
doing so well, Brian. What was it?
You know, Brian came on the New York art scene in like around 1977. And we were all interested because we're all artists. And we had never had much interaction with art rock people before, you know, especially famous rock people. So he was a real curiosity. And
what group was he in?
Come again?
Was he in a group previously?
Well, he originally went to art school and came under the influence of Cornelius Cardew, who's an art composer.
Who just died.
Yeah, in an unfortunate automobile accident. And something that Brian said to me impressed me.
What did he say?
Well, he said, you know, Reese, if I was an art composer, I'd have to go out and get a job. Yeah, I'm a second echelon rock composer. I'm not as famous as Mick Jagger or David Bowie, but still I'm able, you know, to make my way in the world and, you know, make a little bit of money. But if I was an art composer, I'd have to go out and get a job.
That's right.
Because when you think about Philip Glass or Steve Reich, I know Philip better, so I'll talk about Philip. Makes maybe $60,000 a year, which is unheard of for an art composer. But he's at the top of his field.
Yeah, but what was he doing in 75? Because that's
driving
when
a taxi cab.
And that's when I first heard music for 12 parts, and it's one of the most exciting pieces of music
no
I've ever heard in my life.
No matter what you may think about his music, He was a real inspiration.
I love it.
He's a real inspiration for arts and starving artists, because we're living in an age now in the 80s when it's no fun being a starving artist. You know, people judge you by how much money you make. And I think that that is full of blankety blank. And we all looked at Philip, you know, who was like the hippest guy around. And, Steve was doing good stuff too. But with Philip, Steve didn't have to work a job. Philip was a plumber. He did all the plumbing in for everyone's loft and for food restaurant. And, you know, and that was encouraging for all of us who didn't have a private income or anything like that. You know, that someone could really make some good art and be working 40 hours a week at hard physical labor. We were all really proud of him. And, you know, and then after Einstein on the Beach, the opera they did with Robert Wilson, immediately after that, he was driving a cab. Because there were various lawyers' fees that were involved, and never mind about that. But, you know, in his 40s, you know, driving a cab, you know, two kids to support. It was very encouraging to me.
I think his music is exquisite, too. I find it very exciting, personally.
Another thing I was saying about Brian is, like, when we think of his stuff, Brian makes me mad now. Because, you know, I read a thing that he's talked about in Face magazine where he said that there were no good electronic music. All the electronic music of the 50s and 60s was bad and boring. And it wasn't until rock composers got a hold of it that it was interesting. Well, okay, well, you say that, but maybe there'll be people out there that'll agree with what he says. But the thing is, all I want to say is this. What about Edgar Varèse's Poème Électronique, written in 1958? What about Pauline Oliveros? One of Four.
What about Johanna Bayer?
What about Xenakis, Occident Orient, and Bohr One? What about Stockhaus and Himmler? What about Morton Subotnick, The Wild Bull? What about, I mean, I could go on and on.
This is wonderful. We'll have to play all these on the program.
And the thing is that Brian, is a person who should sit at these masters' feet, and that he could make a comment like that, and that he's a Musician magazine last month.
Thank them for their ideas.
With John Cage, you know, and talking with John Cage and licking his ass. And, you know, he's such a turn face. I'm sorry. You know, I mean, that you know, the thing is when he's talking with me, he'll say how he's influenced by various artists. But when he's talking with the rock pests, he doesn't give credit where credit's due. Discreet Strategies, that piece he did, is a direct ripoff of Yoko Ono's Grapefruit. Yoko Ono wrote this
Yoko Ono wrote this wonderful
People don't like her, maybe because some people say she split up the Beatles, but before she met any of them in the 50s, she wrote this book called Grapefruit, one piece after another of performance pieces, you know, performance instructions that were out. Listen to one of them. One of the things that she wrote was, listen to a heartbeat. And the way that she realized that performance instruction was having, like, you know, 10 people, like Lamont Young, John Cage, all these people, and then put contact mics on their heartbeats and amplified them to high hell. And this was the Cherry Lane Theater in the early 60s.
Were you there?
I wasn't there, but I heard about it because I was only 11 years old in 1963. But it was just amazing.
I know the book, very, very, very scary.
You know, and it's amazing. And also, what about Cornelius Cardew and his Scratch Orchestra with all the influence that Brian doesn't give that information in the rock press, you know? And there's this backlash against art music that's going on right now.
Yes. I didn't know.
Well, you hear these post-industrialist groups who are doing noise, you know, saying this
as
one
if they invented it.
Yeah. But also, you know, when they go and do pop music after they do the noise and they say that the noise was just so easy they wanted to do pop music, they're hypocrites because the reason, you know, that they switched were because there's more money, you know, in not doing noise. You know, why did the whole punk thing die? You know, it's because, you know, why do all these groups, like within the rock framework, We had an incredible amount of energy in New York, you know, with people bringing in noise, which is an art idea, into the rock context, you know, and doing something completely new and exciting with it that art composers never would have thought of, and it's really great. But it's not commercial, and so most of the groups died. You know, like James Chance or James White, didn't get famous with the contortions.
I like James White.
You know, he got famous when he started dealing with funk. You know, mm-hmm. it's unfortunate. And the rock groups are figuring it out, and one by one, you know, they stop doing the really creative stuff and go back into this commercial genre.
Are you going to write for strings,
I realize that people
the
out
way?
There, you know, you can really argue with that, and, you know, it's a debatable point, but it's the point of view that I
yeah,
hold.
Yeah, lots of people that listen, especially...
No, because I care about what you all
think.
Three
in the morning and so on, you know, want Brian Eno. They want Bob Marley and
well,
Brian Eno.
Well, I'm not
Eno.
Talking about his music so much. I'm just talking
I
about what he
says.
I don't
even know it. I've got to start listening to it.
I'm talking about the hypocritical aspects that you read, because people read these interviews.
Well, the interviews...
They don't really know the person.
The interviews are caca. I mean... They're so, you know, under the influence
and whatever. Yeah, but how did you
whatever.
Come to music? And how did I come to music? I mean, I read those interviews like they were the word of God.
No, I didn't. I didn't. Well, how did I come to music? Were... I was a bored housewife. I was a bored housewife when I was 35 and I fell in love with my first music teacher. That's how I came to music. Reese, are you going to write for strings ever? Because that's what I like to write for, strings and voice. And I simply,
that's a very
I don't
pertinent
play,
question.
I don't play strings, but I pretend that it's a voice.
Right.
A beautiful voice.
You know, Virgil Thompson wrote something very pertinent in his book, The State of Music, which was written, I think, in the 30s. I'm not sure about it. He said, when you're a young composer of art music, you like to write for percussion. You know, lots of noise, right? And then you get older, like in your 30s and this and that, and you start brass.
Oh,
brass is what you're into.
So
and
here
then,
you're working up to it. I can see.
You get older than that. You get more sublime, right? You know,
it's a sine
strings.
Wave. It's a so sine wave.
I'm not ready for strings yet.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing
and
now.
You know, I'm playing trumpet right now. I know I have two instruments in the future.
Uh-huh.
I really want to master keyboard. You know, I play it.
I like keyboard.
But
I play
just because
it.
It's a real composer's instrument.
Yeah.
That and guitar, I think, are real composer's
you
instruments.
You sing?
And no. And it's a good thing, too.
See, I sing
my
and I play
My father always
keyboard.
Told me, like, don't sing. And he was right.
Oh, come on.
No. Well,
then, you see, he ruined you. Because you could... You
playing
could,
trumpet
any
is every
to me
good as, bit as good as singing,
no,
my dear.
No, how I see it is
it's
that...
It's the same thing.
Any musician
like,
has an ear, and any musician
well,
has
listen,
a voice.
Of course I sing.
And, you know, it's totally a
block. But I
just
don't block. Sing publicly. I don't happen to have a good voice.
You quoted Virgil Thompson in something else, too. Because I was saying
I
that I
didn't
don't...
I also didn't finish my point, which was
oh,
that...
Oh, I'm sorry.
That, at some point, I want to take up a string instrument like what, viola or violin, just so I can. I you know the thing point I wanted
I think
to
you
make
do
Barbara.
Viola.
I have this point I want to make.
What?
Well, that I really like to get into the genre of music I'm working in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when I started doing the guitar pieces, I spent 2 years of research before I did an art music piece based on that. I spent 2 years working with a rock group and understanding on a first-hand level what it is to do it. Movie directors do this all the time.
Oh, of course.
You know, and because I don't believe in appropriation. I believe in an assimilation,
uh-huh.
you know, of my culture. And before I write for strings, I really want to have a string experience, you know, and play
You know, this
it.
Is
I'm
what the people in your band said about you. They said how serious you are about...
Oh, they're so
this
sweet.
Is what they appreciate so much. I mean, it's just this crazed bunch of rowdy, randy kids, but they were so wonderful.
Oh, they're not kids.
No, but they're. I.
There's
everyone's a kid
though.
To me. Everyone's a kid to me because I'm just so old. I didn't mean kids as like 12, but they're very, very, very good players, and they're totally respectful, because just of what you're saying now, and it's wonderful to hear, of saying that you're so committed and that you're so interested in the research and in not jumping into anything quickly, but just knowing. The instrument and knowing the genre and really researching and scoping it out for a year or two, which is wonderful. Because
and they're so encouraging to me too.
Yeah, you were saying that.
They help you know,
you out
it's
with
so
your
nice
instrument?
that they let me play trumpet with them. Because
you know,
they've all been
Juilliard
playing for 15
people.
Years.
Yeah,
Juilliard, Manhattan
amazing.
School of Music,
they're
Eastman
amazing
School.
Musicians.
One of them went to what's that school in Vermont? Bennington.
Yeah. I was there.
You know, and they let me play with them, and it's just great. And they give me advice, and they're not stuck up or anything.
Yeah, you know, it was great when you walked
terrific.
Out on the stage, too.
Were
the
my
first,
hands shaking?
Well, the first piece, Reese doesn't play, and then he walks out in the second piece, and they're all smiling, and they're so happy that he's there to conduct. You know, I thought that was great. An unesoteric question. What do you cook?
What do I cook?
Yeah. Reese just can't believe these questions.
Well,
like
I used,
going,
to, be,
what?
I used to be a professional cook. I used to cook. I did, Barbara. I used to cook French cuisine and American food.
Wait, when was this?
This was in 1975 at a bar, at the Tin Palace, which was a now defunct bar on the Bowery in
near John Jorno's.
Near Phoebe's, and then later on in Sub-Bossex. And I got so sick of it after a year, but I graduated to bartending.
Uh huh. Yeah, I could see you as a bartender.
Yeah, and the owner of the bar at Sub-Bossex. Well, one time we had a very slow night because it was raining outside, and I gave. Well, at that point it was American cuisine, so we're basically cooking hamburgers. And I gave the dishwasher. I taught the dishwasher how to do it, and I played piano all night. And I got fired from being a cook for doing it.
Oh, I love it.
You know, because I wasn't supposed to hire the dishwasher the night when
really?
There was no
really? What a con.
Business. And the owner, who is also he was a crazed painter, said, "Reese, I think you'll be more happy as a bartender in this establishment." So I became a bartender, and it was great.
It certainly is easier than cooking.
Yeah. No,
because
you have to do all that prep
over
work.
Hot, yeah.
You know, and it's
remember
like
the,
I spent 10-hour shifts as a cook.
Remember the chicken that you sent me to?
Well, no,
I
was getting
to
that, Barbara.
To
I was getting to that.
I want to cook a chicken for
because
Reese
after that thing
Michael.
At Sub-Bossex, I didn't cook for 10 years. And it wasn't
no
until
wonder.
I just got so off it. You know, I would go out and eat. And it wasn't Barbara came to a home that I was sharing with my friend and colleague, Michael Byron. On McDougal Street in an area of Manhattan that's called the Scarsdale of Little Italy, 56 McDougal Street, and cooked us his chicken. And I was so inspired that that's what I'm cooking right now. I'm cooking at home.
No, you went to the butcher nearby. Wasn't there a butcher nearby?
Oh, tell them that story.
No, I don't remember that story. No, this is Reese. I can't believe what he's telling me. I do believe him because he's an honest person. He was brought up well.
But with a limited memory.
But like, all this is what there was in the house. Like, empty bottles of ragu. Ragu sauce. That's all there was.
Like, that was from the pasta I was cooking.
They had what? I don't know if they had one plate. I'm not kidding. They had one plate and one fork. And Sam Ashley and I, Sam was staying with Mimi and Bob. And like, but Sam came for dinner. He was hanging around with us a lot. Remember, he gave us all haircuts and stuff.
And don't tell what else we did.
I'm not. But he gave us haircuts, remember?
Right. And he gave me a haircut.
What?
He gave me a haircut,
yes,
too.
Yes, everybody.
Wow.
And there was all this ragu around, you know, except Reese would make me this coffee in big bowls. That was so hip, you know, because, you
I
know,
had
Michael
very good coffee
was
there.
Gone or asleep or dead. And Reese
not
would just
dead.
Carry around my Casio. And I'd say to Michael, I'm going to get a taxi now because I have to go to Port Authority and then I'm going to the plane. Could you carry my suitcase and my Casio down? And Michael would go, nope. So then I'd have to get Reese to do it. And I'd say, Reese, you know, would you do it? And Reese would go, of course, you know, little sweetheart would just take it right downstairs. Michael got mad, remember, though, when... one morning, I think, you know, Reese just got into bed with us, just a snuggle, and Michael got all uptight. So Reese left, and then I said, Michael, Reese is really insulted. And then Michael's going, Reese, you can come back. But by then, Reese was already practicing. Reese was composing, you know. Reese believes 2 hours of composing a day, even if he's doing a 40-hour construction.
I believe 2 hours in the morning.
That's what I mean.
And 2 hours in the evening.
Oh, my God.
No, I
this is dedication.
I have to.
I'm serious. I'm so impressed.
You have to.
You are inspiring me.
When I was working a full-time job, I was working as a construction worker last year. For a period of 3 months, and then I could only you cannot look. You do construction work. You come home from work. All you want to do is drink beer, watch TV,
and watch Three's Company. And, that's what I do.
Yeah, and other things. And
I know
but
what
so
the
what
other
I would do is
are.
Get up
that's
at 6
F
in the morning and work
four,
for 2 hours to get my work
word.
Done. And I did some of my best work that way.
Reese is so clean. He will not say anything. But you know, you and I know what he means.
Well, I just don't want to say anything over the air, but they can't put on the air, but you get
well,
in trouble for.
Well, I say frigging all the time.
Yeah. Well, a friend
of
mine, Jim Burton, did this piece where he used every single curse word in the book, and
I want to
put it over
him.
A Pacifica station, WBAI, and they got in so much trouble for
really?
It that I've always been very careful.
Well, I do this
about
I do this mainly at 3.
My choice
but
of words on the radio.
This interview is so long that I know what's going to happen. I'm going to play Reese Chatham for 4. Seriously, this is how I'm going to do it. I'm going to play you all night and then intersperse all this. So by now, we're at the tail end, and people who are just waking up are going to be hearing this. And people who are just waking up phone me up now, and they go, who programs this music? And I say, I do. And they say, do you know what it's like to wake up to this? And I say, yes, and I would like to wake up to this. And, you know, so, you know, you can't.
Well, I'll give you some good wake-up music, too.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I have some very relaxing pieces. Okay. I'll put that on.
Okay, excellent.
But you can play it around 7 in the morning or 6.
I'm satisfied.
Listen, I care. I really care about everybody out there.
Do you hear that? Rhys Chatham cares about you all. And we're going to eventually get a tape of his opera, which we'll be hearing in Brattle, Massachusetts, in April or May of 86. And we're looking forward to having Rhys Chatham back again in San Francisco with us.
And I'm looking forward to being back here. Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you, Rhys.